In a world where action films are dumped in theaters and TV, dead on arrival.
I can't go on living this lie!
You need a hero.
Last time I trusted someone, I lost an eye.
You need a helper.
Hello, hello, nothing to see here.
You need a healer.
That is affirmative.
You need...
We're on the air.
Professor Rick's Action Film Autopsy.
Hey, everybody, it's... Professor Rick's Action Film Autopsy, and we're going to start up top with there'll be spoilers. Anyway, we're in our mobile sound. We're now in Miko's mobile sound studio.
Yes.
Recording, and introduce yourselves as always.
Hi, I'm Miko. That's it. I mean, all the listeners should know me. If not, I work at Blue Sky.
Hi, my name is Jen. I also work at Blue Sky, and I run an animation website called animationcomplex.com.
Do you really?
Yes.
Is it actually up there? Can we find it?
I said a website, not a podcast.
Okay, that's right. the website is up. I have to get on the website.
Oh, yeah, the website's up. There's one podcast and one YouTube video and a couple of articles.
Nice. How many hours of indecision were involved in those?
Years.
Years and months. Longer than you've been alive.
Honestly.
Well, I have to say, the video was relatively fast because I edited it. I am the executive editor.
Okay.
In this.
All right, let's start a fight right off the bat.
I was kind of just like, you want to throw down on the Action Film Autopsy Podcast?
Yes, not only the Action Film Autopsy Podcast, but the Spring Forward episode of the Action Film Autopsy. We've got a lot of stuff to talk about. So the question is here, guys, we've seen a couple of things together. There's a bunch, we've seen different ones, but the one I've seen that you haven't seen, for sure, is Call of Heroes. Which is an actual old-fashioned kung fu movie. Oh, by the way, is anybody else recording this in case of backup?
No.
In case of any problems?
No, I'm not. My battery's, dying.
All right, then. Well, see if you can put one up, Miko, talking. While I'm talking about Call of Heroes. Call of Heroes is a really old-fashioned Hong Kong kung fu film directed and written by Benny Chan, plus Tam Wai Ching, who he also co-wrote it. He wrote White Storm and Operation Mekong, which are two of the better, more recent action movies. Not really kung fu action, but Call of Heroes is an old-fashioned kung fu movie. In fact, basically he's given nearly co-director status, the action director Sammo Hung, the great Sammo Hung. And he really shows off. It's really funny at the end when it looks like everybody's going to be killed by the encroaching army after they finally spend that one of those glorious Hong Kong climaxes, which goes on for a half an hour to 45 minutes of them trying to kill the most heinous villain imaginable, and they can't quite kill him, and finally, ultimately, they do. But throughout the whole movie, the heinous villain is the son of the general who's going to be coming to the little village and wipe it out if the son isn't released from jail, and it's a Western, it's a kind of a Western feeling kung fu film.
So is it more like an homage, or is it just the guy just straight up made an old school kung fu film?
No, it's more of an homage. At this point, it's all kind of a last gasp because of the Chinese cinema, what's happening to Chinese cinema nowadays. But I was going to say, the general who saves their butt at the end, you just see him for a second, he rides in with his army at the last minute, he's played by Sammo.
It's like Gandalf in Two Towers.
Yeah, but it's played by Sammo. Sammo just rides through on the horse, and you go, oh yeah, after he did all this amazing choreography. Because it's a really old school Hong Kong kung fu adventure. It takes place in the time of the warring nations and the warring bands, like the early 1900s. And Louis Koh plays this son of this evil general, and he comes into this little town.
Louis Koh?
K-O-O.
His name is Louis?
Is his name Louis? Let me look that up again. Louis Koh.
Like, it's not a Chinese name.
I know. I'm using, in other words, it's the star is Lau Ching-Wan, who is this awesome, soulful, who plays the mad detective in the Johnny To movie. But his name in English is Sean. Sean Low. So Louis Koh is the villain. He starts the movie by shooting an old man, a child, And then a young lady in the mouth.
Oh, good. It's not a dog, though.
No, it's not a dog. The dogs survive. And Eddie Pang is in it, and Wu Jing is in it. And Eddie Pang and Wu Jing play these students of these military guys who have split up, and Eddie Pang has become a wanderer, and Wu Jing stays as the bodyguard of the general's son. And they have an astonishing, wonderful battle on top of wine jugs at the end, a mountain of wine jugs. And they have this great, it's very much like the 18 legendary poles. Not legendary poles, the 18, not, they're not 18 poles, they're Shaolin poles. Secret of the Shaolin poles. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, they exercise by stepping on poles. You saw it in Iron Monkey and stuff like that. But these were like gigantic wine jugs, the kind of drunken master wine jugs. But it was an entire mountain full. So it was really, really sweet. It was really good. There's some wires and there's some CG, but for the most part, and also there was a bunch of actors who really weren't trained in martial arts, because Sammo was there. He trained everybody. Everybody looked really credible. It was really nice to see authentic Kung Fu, an old-fashioned kind of Shaw Brothers, Golden Harvest type of Hong Kong Kung Fu movies. So that got me ready for everything else. Because then what we did see together was Logan. Now, Logan is directed by James Mangold, directed and written by James Mangold. And what a great name, Mangold. Unfortunately, he should be named Man Silver, or Man Copper, or Man Bronze. Because as honorable as he is, and as ambitious as he is, and as art-like, not artful, but kind of art-light he is, because he did Copland, Walk the Line, the remake of 310 to Yuma, Night and Day, that Tom Cruise movie, and the recent Wolverine movie. Mm-hmm. He makes good movies.
Wait, the last Wolverine movie?
Yeah, the one.
The one where he goes to Japan?
Yeah, the one in Japan.
Jesus Christ.
Okay. Well, there was one good thing in that. Yeah, but the point is, he's trying, but for some reason he makes good movies, and sometimes not so good movies, but for the most part, he never makes great movies. Mm. Even something like Walk the Line, which was the Johnny Cash story.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember sitting in the theater going, and also Copland, and 310 to Yuma, So Logan, which is, I give it a B.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I give it a solid B. Again, but it's, he seems to think that you make something classic or great by showing something four times rather than two times.
Yes.
Yeah, that happened a bunch.
Yes. He likes to pump it up to give the impression that it is more powerful than it is. But it's funny, I was thinking about this. Even the longest movies, the longest great movies I've ever seen, never seem long.
Mm-hmm.
They always really move along.
Right.
Whether it's Lawrence of Arabia or Bridge on the River Kwai or The Dirty Dozen or whatever, I'm never sitting there going, oh yeah, he's holding this shot too long. Oh, why are they showing that again? Why are they making a point again of the same thing?
Like the adamantium bullet and the gun.
Yeah,
it's like, we get it.
Yeah.
We get it. We know how he's going to die.
A great director would show things three times. Could show three times.
But three is so cliche
Slowly ramp up each time.
Right.
Intensity. This one was pretty much the same intensity and same sort of just passing the knowledge.
Right.
Yeah, so it didn't really add on more to the story. It just made the story feel long. I checked my watch twice.
Yeah, and also when the good director does it, he always shows a slightly different thing about it.
Right.
You know, he adds to the story and to the character. He wouldn't show the thing again unless he added to the story or the character with showing it again.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And, you know, building it. And here it's just kind of like, here it is again, it is again. And also, he doesn't seem to understand the rhythm of an audience member. You know, you kind of want to be surfing throughout the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And when the swell comes, you want to ride the swell. And here he kind of like, there was moments where I think I saw all of us kind of like get anticipatory.
Mm-hmm.
We sort of like sat up or leaned forward a little bit, and then we had to lean back again.
Yeah.
Because then he stopped the movie dead and went back to the same old point again.
It was very stop and go, and it was kind of annoying because it was just like half the movie was just like travel montage.
Always. Here we are in our studio, and always we have an alarm
There's
going.
There's always
up.
One.
Oh
yeah. But anyway, we'll keep going. and hopefully it'll stop.
Yeah, it's like right there. I don't see anybody near it.
Oh, gosh.
Oh, no.
Should we stop it?
I think we should pause for now.
Okay. So, it has a fight choreographer named Steve Brown, who was previously a stuntman on X-Men Apocalypse and Batman v Superman. The stunt coordinator was a guy named Garrett Warren, who was the stunt coordinator on Passengers, of all things, fight coordinator on X-Men Apocalypse. And the fights were fun at first.
Oh, it was so annoying.
It was brutal.
She never used her feet. She used her feet like once.
Yeah, we have
so
to jump
annoyed.
Back.
Okay, because like I
back.
Was looking for. No, I'm sorry. I'm just gonna go in right now. Like I think I give in general. Like I feel like I was more invested in this movie than you two. Because I feel like, I mean, for me,
what?
Like, well, maybe not, I don't even know, but you was
because
kind
of the strong girl character?
Not even that, no, like, for me, it was like, I remember my brother and I dragging my mom to this, like, to see the first X-Men, and she thought it was animated, so she was super unexcited to see this movie, and, like, I love these, and then in X-Men Evolution, that's when the character of X-23 was first introduced, and she was such a badass, so then to see her in this as, like, this little Spanish girl, it was just, like, perfect. And then I kept waiting for the feet, the claws on the feet, and we only saw it like twice.
Well, once or twice, yeah.
Once or twice, yeah.
Twice, definitely twice.
Which is a shame,
but
because,
quickly.
Yeah, quickly. Which because they introduce it as something that unique to her because she's a female.
Yeah, it's another one of these movies where it, even though movies, as you well know, are not done usually in order, they jump all over the place during the production house. This seemed to be. It seemed to be done in order because it started well.
Mm-hmm.
They introduced the characters well. There was some very strong work by everyone. And then as the movie went on, it just starts degenerating, just deteriorating. But I was going to say about the action, they introduce her fairly early, and she's involved in the X-23 in the first couple of fight scenes.
Right.
But what I remembered about the fight scenes is that this is an R-rated movie. It starts, it obviously is born of Deadpool's success. Because they have a little short subject with Deadpool at the beginning. A short subject that disappointed me. Because they used the Deadpool introduction as a way to do yet another homage, satire, of the Christopher Reeve, Richard Donner Superman movie.
Mm-hmm.
It was all a joke about him trying to switch his costume in a phone booth.
Mm-hmm.
And they used the Superman theme and all this stuff. And they recently, on the Christmas special for Doctor Who, they ruined it by doing another homage to the Christopher Reeve, Richard Donner Superman. And Superman Returns, which was directed by Bryan Singer, who became famous by doing X-Men movie, was another homage.
Mm-hmm.
I said, yes, it's a great movie, but you're making your own movie. So why not make that as great rather than trot out another homage? So that worried me.
Mm-hmm.
And then my worry got a little paid off because the actual Logan movie, which started well and was nice. I think somebody was complaining. Larry Hama, who's a comic guy and was acknowledged on a bunch of the recent comic movies because he's created so much in comics that are now being adapted to movies. He said, "Why is everybody hating on Logan?"
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote him back saying, "I think it's bleak fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
I think people are just tired." Of, you know, this darkness that's encroaching into the 20th Century Fox Marvel movies and, of course, the DC Warner Brothers movies.
Right.
And so, but it still was a good movie, just not a great movie, because Mangold, the editing, it was clearly stuff was taken out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was abrupt and abruptly edited from time to time. So the plot kind of lurched along when it really should be smooth and fast and hard.
And I have to say, one of the most disappointing thing for me in terms of fighting was that at the end they sort of fight together, X-23 and Logan fought together,
but like only so much,
but not well.
Only a little bit.
Yeah.
And I wish they could have done more of showing how they sort of, because their relationship developed throughout this whole movie.
Yeah.
So the fact that at the end when they had a chance to fight together, I can't believe they didn't show more, and I can't believe they didn't show it well enough.
We were talking about that, because at the beginning, I was going to say that this was born of Deadpool, and Deadpool was born of being an R-rated superhero movie, so this was an R-rated movie. So at first, it was kind of cool and shocking to see Wolverine put his adamantium claws right through people's heads.
Yeah.
I mean, basically...
Cut off the hands.
Yeah. It was like John Wick 2 all over again with headshots. Constant putting the claws through the heads. Mm-hmm. But the problem for me, of course, is that as the movie went on, I became inured to it.
Yeah.
It was like, yeah, he does that every time. It's not shocking anymore. Mm-hmm. You might think about doing it differently.
Yes.
So that we're engaged. There's a scene where Professor X loses his brain in a Las Vegas hotel, threatening the lives of everybody around them. And like the Japanese Wolverine movie where he uses the claws to crawl across the top of the bullet train, here he's using it to crawl down the hallway of planting his claws in the wall, so he's able to pull himself forward against this powerful psychic force. And that was kind of cool. But again, once he got into the room, claws in the head, claws in the head, claws in the heads. Yeah, and also you can tell, I don't know, you guys being animators or involved in animation, that it was all CGI.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
You know?
There are some bad CGIs there where it kind of takes you out from the film, because some of the background, some of the mat wasn't done well, so you can kind of see a halo effect in the character.
It sucks for you that you noticed that kind of thing, because I have to be really looking for it to see that.
I didn't have to look. It was
I know,
obvious.
That's what I'm saying. For me, it's like I just like block it out.
When it looks unnatural, it takes... You block it out, but it takes me out of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
When I see it, it's kind of like, oh, okay, well, whatever.
Well, it's like, for me, it's like, I guess I haven't seen it yet, but like the Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah.
Like... The newest Beauty and the Beast, like, I'm just going to be distracted by how ugly everybody is the entire time.
We were talking about this. What was the good live-action adaptation that Disney did? It was The Jungle Book.
I was going to be like, oh, the 101 Dalmatians movie when we were little.
Yeah, well, no.
That one was good.
But they actually, yeah, they used to be.
CG's probably absolute garbage now.
Yeah, but the point, that's the point. Remake mediocre to bad movies. Don't remake great classics.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
You cannot win if you do that.
Yeah.
They should remake The Black Cauldron, not Beauty and the Beast, and not all these other, not Lion King.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't improve on those things.
Yeah, the expectation for the original is so high. That
Robin
hard
Hood
to...
with like...
Yeah, Robin Hood.
Hyper-realistic anthropomorphic animals.
Yeah, or any number, or whatever. There's deers in the forest or whatever. But anyway, back to Logan.
Mm-hmm.
I've got increasingly disappointed because they also, in this movie, introduced the X-Kids.
Yeah.
And X-Kids could have been, again, the movie builds, it has an evil Logan, and I liked that metaphor.
Oh, I didn't like it.
You didn't like the metaphor?
I thought it was like just super like, of course he's got an evil clone. Like, you know, it was like Scott Pilgrim fighting his evil, like, you know.
But that's like the perfect copy.
But that's why people do it. Like, I get it. Yeah. I get it. But like, I was just
it worked. For me, it worked perfectly well.
I mean, it worked that this was the end for him and he was going to die.
And Logan had spent his entire existence fighting himself.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. Like, it was like, I gave it a pass while watching it because I was like, well, like, fine. Like, okay,
but
like,
I didn't,
your ending, this is your swan song.
But that's the point. I didn't give it a pass at the end of it,
mm-hmm.
because it was a great idea, which was then not paid off.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They introduced the X-Kids, and I said, oh, and of course my anticipation comes up, oh, they're going to introduce them as the X-Kids, and they're going to band together, and by the end of it, it's going to be clear they're going to be the next X-teens, mm-hmm. and X-tweens, and X-adults, and X-men,
mm-hmm.
and women,
mm-hmm.
but they don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Again, they just drop that ball.
But don't you think that would be, like, really corny if they did that?
I don't mind. I mean, I forgot who said it, but I always quote it, which is, I know Lee Marvin said, play your cliche straight, they'll be blinded by your genius,
mm-hmm.
but I also remember somebody else said, do not play against the emotion. Play toward the emotion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so basically, that's, if you do that and you do it well, maybe Mangold would not have been able to do it well and he chickened out on it.
I feel like you could
but
kind
if
of
did it well, it would work.
You could either have that or you could have the cross getting turned to the X, and I feel like
I think you could do
like
both.
That was corny.
You can do both.
But
you
like, I mean, but that was really corny too. Like, I appreciate
that
it.
Is corny. It's well done because we know it's a period. So towards this long journey of you know, Logan being Logan, I would have to say for the X-Kids, I feel like, again, maybe they run out of budget to do VFX.
But that like upshot because of them all in the circle killing that guy that wasn't enough for you?
The main villain. No, because they, first of all, I was telling this to Miko after we saw it, that they didn't kill him. They were in the process of killing him, but they don't show it.
Yeah. Right.
And it's like, I'm sure they filmed it,
yeah.
but they're sort of like, oh, we're going to hedge our bets, and we're not going to actually show him because maybe we'll bring him back. And I hate when they do that.
I don't think they'll make an... What X-Men movies are they making
If this
now?
Was successful.
Yeah.
But
right.
apparently it wasn't that successful.
Oh, yeah?
It was probably... I think Kong wiped the...
Oh, yeah, Kong
the box
wiped
office with it.
At that weekend.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, with the kids... They didn't, when they were getting chased and all that stuff, when they fight back, they didn't really show them fighting back.
And also...
They didn't show the power.
They didn't show them working as a team.
Right.
Coming together against this thing.
But I feel like that would be for the next one.
But if... Yes, it would be for the next one. But even so, like, I've always said, if you're going to make a movie, make a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And if you make a movie, there'll be a next one. If you don't make a movie, there won't be a next one.
Yeah, I get that.
I mean, you know, I was so happy that the original Batman and The Fugitive, they made a movie. They finished the story.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't do that. I hate it when they introduced the sequel. Although I didn't mind it tonight. We'll talk about the movie we saw tonight. But I did love... The one thing I really loved in this movie was the Logan's last line.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Logan's last line was very well done. I really admired it. I've talked about it with several other people that said, did you realize the double meaning? Because what he says, what does he say? Is this what it's like?
This is what it feels like.
It's, yeah, in the
but
realm
you
of
think
that.
He's referring to death, but he's also referring to
love.
To actually loving someone.
Yeah.
Right.
Which he finds out that,
and
you know, he's 23
so.
And being loved unselfishly. So that was cool. But the movie itself, again, I give a B. It's not as good as it could have been. Mm-hmm. But it certainly was a heck of a lot better.
Yeah, needed like another
than
editing
it could have
cut.
Been. Yeah, yeah. And by the way, I noticed that when I was looking up the fight choreographers and stuff like that, there was a bunch of reshoot credits.
Really?
There were a lot of people in various places on reshoots, and obviously the reshoots on the basis of the credits list, and we'll put it. Well, of course, I'll put the links in the supplemental. There seemed to be a lot. Most of the action scenes had reshoots and things like that there.
I wonder why.
Me too. But we could see when we were watching the movie that there was clearly things that were taken out or put in. It lurched along. It wasn't as smooth and as strong as it should have been. But it was still worthwhile. The fighting was okay, but they didn't, as usual, go as far as they need to go. Again, here we have a bunch of people with very specific powers that could be used in a way that was engaging, amusing, entertaining, exciting, involving, interesting, and they just kept it as adamantium claws through the head.
Mm-hmm.
Adamantium claws through the head. So what do you want to do? Do you want to do Get Out?
Sure.
We all saw Get Out, which is Jordan Peele's comedy horror film. Would you call it a...
I would not call it a comedy.
What would you call it? The best parts of it were comedy, though.
Yeah.
It is a scary film.
It was
film.
Interesting because when we went into it, we went and saw it with our other friends, and my one friend was like, oh, isn't it like kind of like an Edgar Wright, like kind of like genre spoof on like horror films? And I was like, no. I'm like, I heard it was like a real, like a proper horror film.
Yeah.
And we were both like,
right.
One of us is right and one of us is wrong. And I think we were both, yeah, like I get what you're saying, but I think...
It's somewhat
it highlights,
in the middle.
But I think with that movie, it's like it highlights like real, like bigger issues. Like I feel like it's not
right to
call it like even like a comedy so much as it's just like calling out how absurd their things are for
people. It's a satire.
Yeah. Social
but a
satire.
Scary. Yeah, it's like a scary movie satire.
Well, it's funny. I didn't find it, you know, for me, it was a variation on the Stepford Wives. I felt it was a very slow burn.
Mm-hmm.
I felt it should have been more than 90 minutes.
I checked the clock at one point.
You did?
Yeah.
I personally didn't, actually.
I checked the clock and I was like, there's another, like, it was like another 50 minutes and I was like, what the fuck is gonna, like, I was like, oh my God, like, come on.
They spent a lot of setup time.
They do spend a lot of setup time, which is, like, for me, I like it. And Jen has a coworker who said this movie was a pretty tight movie.
Yeah.
And I felt it's kind of the same, meaning that all of the actions and all of the sort of the build-up served a common purpose. And there isn't really a lot of loopholes or...
No, there's none of that. It's just that, for me, it was like an hour-long Twilight Zone episode.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see the need for an hour and 45 minutes. Although, I did check my watch once.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sort of like going, you know, I'll be honest. I'm pretending I saw the whole movie. I actually went to see... I was going to see, after being at the Big Apple Comic-Con, I wanted to go see something at the wonderful AMC Empire 25 on 42nd Street. Usually that's where they show Indian movies and Thai movies and Korean movies and Japanese movies and Chinese movies. And I was hoping there'd be a great Chinese movie like Call of Heroes, mm-hmm. but there wasn't. So I went. I had like an hour, 15 minutes before I was going to see Sword Art Online, the movie, mm-hmm. Japanese anime, which was quite good. And I was looking for anything to see other than Get Out, because we were going to all see Get Out together.
Right.
But it was I'd seen everything else, and I didn't want to see Logan again, so mm-hmm. I went to see Get Out. So, but I only saw, like, the last hour.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
And I was sitting there going, what did they spend the first 45 minutes on? Because as far as I could tell, it was a one linear story.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they did in the first 45 minutes establish another African-American character who was brought in.
They did. In the beginning, yeah, they did. In the very beginning, they set up this relationship, this friendship between the character.
Oh, yeah, but the TSA character.
Yeah, the TSA
yeah.
character.
Yeah, but that's fine. But he wasn't a guy who was being victimized by this bunch of white people who were invading their minds.
No, but it's really interesting because... he calls him a lot during it, and then at the beginning, they put him on speakerphone, and, like, the girlfriend, like, they have, like, you think it's like, oh, look, she has such a great relationship with his best friend, because she's always, like, kind of, like, hitting on him in, like, a joking way, but then you're like, oh, she's, like, totally, like, trying to, like...
She's actually manipulating him.
She's trying
him.
To, like, manipulate him to
but
be
But he was a great
victim.
Character.
Yeah.
And I knew, I'm almost certain that he was the Jordan Peele character. If Jordan could have played that, he would have.
Yeah.
But he cast these wonderful guys. Did you hear about that little controversy about casting the lead guy because he's not American?
Oh, because he's British? Who
he was British. Yeah, but apparently, Samuel L. Jackson called about and he called him. He said, why do I have to defend myself?
Oh, my God.
Why do I have to prove my American blackness?
I was like, there's so many... times where that happens and like who the hell cares?
Yeah, he's black. Like,
yeah,
it doesn't matter what country he's from.
Again, we want American actors, whatever. But he was great.
Mm-hmm.
The movie was good.
Mm-hmm.
And at my screening, that was one of the reasons I was really happy to see it in New York, because I was with a New York crowd,
mm-hmm.
and they rocked and rolled.
Oh, I bet.
And during that scene where the TSA guy goes to the cop.
Yeah.
They were laughing. They were shouting back at the screen.
Yeah.
But I have to admit, they wanted to do it more, and the movie didn't let them do it more.
Mm-hmm.
Because the movie was very small.
For me, it was
a small focus.
The quote-unquote plot twist with the police car at the end.
Yeah, that wasn't a plot twist.
I thought it was going to be the cop from the beginning.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure... Because
he's the only cop that we saw, so...
But it could have been just another white cop.
No, I know, but he's... Yeah, that's why they set up in the beginning with the white cop, so you kind of have that feeling, another cop car around this area, this so secluded area, it has to be him.
Like, I knew he was going to get out of it alive, because I knew that... With everything happening right now...
And Jordan Peele writing a director.
Right.
I knew Jordan Peele wouldn't make a bleak ending for this movie.
Wouldn't do a Stepford Wives ending.
Yeah.
Right,
Stepford Wives ending is that the bad guys win.
Yeah.
Here the story is...
It's like he wants people to feel hopeful in like this shitty time.
Yeah, these white people have this process where they can take over the bodies of other people, so they can take old people and put them into young people's bodies.
Right.
And for some reason, these old people have decided that being African-American is hip now. So they all want African-American
also,
bodies.
Also, there's an underlining thing also. The grandpa lost to,
the runner who, like, flipped off Hitler, basically?
Oh, yeah, Jesse Owens.
Jesse Owens. Yeah. So he lost that, so they want that physical, like, sort of ability.
There's a line in there about, like, genetic superiority.
Right.
Which was interesting, because you always, unfortunately, hear the opposite.
They hear the opposite. And the other thing is that their fatal flaw is if you put off a flash in their faces, the trapped part of the original body's mind will be able to be released.
Released, yes.
And that leads to the ending, a very satisfying but still made me raise my eyebrow ending, in which the girl who has, the young woman, Allison Williams, she's played by, who is getting all these black guys into this mess by pretending to love them, gives her, was it a grandfather, I think?
Yes.
In the new body.
Right.
He, our hero was able to flash in his face with his phone.
Mm-hmm.
And, but the telltale sign that he's had the flash is that they bleed from the nose.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They have a nosebleed. And I thought she saw the nosebleed because he turns around and takes the rifle from her to kill our hero, mm-hmm. and then kills her or shoots her instead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Shoots her in the stomach. And I said, well, didn't she see the nosebleed?
No, she didn't, though.
She didn't have a nosebleed.
No, the guy did.
No, the guy did.
The guy did.
She didn't see the first time the guy.
That,
she wasn't there.
Oh, that's right. She wasn't there.
She wasn't there. Yeah, yeah. The main character was by himself when the flash happened because he was trying to prove who that person is. So she wasn't there. She was somewhere else.
Right.
And so she didn't know.
So basically, there's this character of our hero's friend who's of what would you call him? He's not fast talking. He's natural talking. He's
natural.
Full of life,
mm-hmm.
and he's a funny guy, and he keeps on saying he's with the TSA, and he's very proud of that, and he's at the airport, and they set that up very well. So at the end, when it looks like our hero's not going to get away, the cop car comes up with the flashing lights, and just like you said, everybody in the audience is going, oh, shit, it's either going to be the cops that the TSA guy went mm-hmm. to, or it's going to be a white local cop, mm-hmm. and it's going to be a bleak ending. But then, you know, I think the best shot of the movie, certainly by the way my audience reacted to it,
uh-huh.
you see the door open and you see the TSA mm-hmm. on the door,
mm-hmm. yeah.
and my audience erupted.
Yeah.
Everybody started going crazy.
He's the comic relief, but he's also the savior of the film, which is
right.
fantastic.
Yeah, literally, because he's a breath of fresh air throughout the whole movie.
Right.
He acts
right.
in a very natural way,
mm-hmm.
and he's not one of these stupid movie characters who goes, oh, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know what's going to happen. He tells him straight up.
Yeah, he says, the whole thing, they're going to use you as a sex slave.
Sex slave.
And sure enough, they kind of try.
Mm-hmm.
But let's get to the action, because they had a stunt coordinator, Mark Vansolo, who was very famous for the guy who did the Deadpool test footage.
Oh.
Not the actual movie, but the thing that sold the Deadpool movie. He also is Liam Neeson's double. And did some stunt coordinating on Taken 3. Taken 3, he does. And so the fight in this one, it's a very short fight.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of cool
mm-hmm.
when our hero, also I love the little trick, there'll be spoilers, where he's hypnotized, the mother of the person who got him into this mess has hypnotized him, and she's able to control him utterly with just the sound of a spoon on a teacup.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the trigger.
Yeah, but he's strapped down to a chair, but unfortunately it's a stuffed chair, unfortunately for them, fortunately for him, and he uses the stuffing to plug his ears.
Right, and he found that out because of his own tendencies. Because when he's young,
he was
that's what he's doing. So that link. So that was really good.
That was really good.
A small detail.
I was just really.
It was nothing but small details.
Yeah,
but
saved him. That his little dirty habit saved him.
But then I was pissed that he took it out.
He
took out the stuffing in his ears, and I'm going, what, are you an idiot?
I understood it in that, like, he didn't want to get ambushed from behind. I understood it from, like, he should have had them with him.
Yeah.
So he winds up, he whacks the brother with, I forgot, a croquet mallet?
No, with a croquet ball.
A bocce ball.
And then I was pissed because he should have fucking been dead.
Yeah.
And then he
kills them. They fight over the teacup, and he knocks the teacup out of her hand.
Mm-hmm.
And I was afraid it was going to hit the ground and set him off, but it doesn't. And then he stabs her with a penknife.
Well, first, when he first supposedly kills the brother, he stabs the dad with like the stag head.
Yeah, they had this mm-hmm. Stag head on the wall of the place he was being held, and he took it and uses
which
it
you
as
also
a
referenced
spear.
Back in the middle where you didn't see they hit a deer.
Right,
that was the beginning.
Right.
Not
yeah, that
the
was
middle.
The beginning.
That was literally the beginning.
Yeah, the beginning.
There were two parts of this movie where I was like, what the fuck?
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it was the deer at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I get it in terms of setting up the movie, and I get, like, metaphors, but I'm like, come on. Like, really, they hit a deer on the way here?
Deer in the headlights, whatever, you know.
And then the second one was the son, like, came back and fought after his head had been, like, gouged in.
But I have to admit I like that, too, because what's happening is that the brother is holding on to our hero, and the hero keeps trying to go for the door.
Yeah. Oh,
and
yeah.
I'm thinking that was really stupid.
Yeah.
Until he does it the third time, and I realize what he's trying to do, which is to get the brother who's holding him from behind to kick the door closed so he can get the knife into the guy's leg.
Yeah, I didn't realize that until it happened, and I was like, oh, shit.
That was sweet. That was sweet. So Get Out was fun, but not really an action film.
He had, in that one moment, he had better fighting techniques than Logan did.
Yes, that's right. He did in that one moment.
Oh, sick burn. I would have to say, though, they did reference, again, in the beginning of the film where the brother said that, so what happens if I put you in a spot where, like, you're dangerous and you're by yourself, you will turn into a beast. And he did, because he killed everyone without mercy.
Yeah.
Until the grandma.
Yeah.
And, well, yes.
When he hit the grandma, he wasn't able to do it because his mom got hit and run, and he kind of have that flashback.
It's a very well written, very nicely directed, very structured, very nicely structured thing, with no wasted motion, but again, with what little action it had, the action wasn't as great as I wanted it to be, but it was awful close because he used it in the way that you should, which is the action adds to the character and it adds to the plot.
Go ahead. No,
don't apologize.
Like, just really quick, the one other random thing that I really appreciated about this movie was that there was no white savior, or there was no white character for everybody else, like all the non-black audience members, to be like, oh, well, if I was in this situation, like, I'd be that guy, like, to latch onto.
Right.
Because that was the thing, like, I love Hidden Figures, but, like, every movie has this, where it's, like, there's always the one white person who, like, needs to, like, kind of be, like, the retribution for all the other people to be like, oh, well, not everybody was like that back then.
To represent the non-racist.
Because at first, for the longest time, like, Allison Williams' character was, like, doing everything right.
Yeah.
And then she turned on him. And then, like, even before that, like, for a while, I thought maybe, like, the artist, the blind artist, would be the guy. I'm like, oh, maybe he's, like, actually not a bad person.
Right, right, right.
Or even, like, the Asian. Like, I was like, oh, I'm like, one of these is probably, like, going to be involved further in the story. And then I was super happy. Like, obviously, I wasn't happy that, like, everyone turned on him. But, like, I was
story.
Yeah, there was a movie when you can't latch onto things and think that I would be that person if this thing would have happened.
Yeah.
There's no one there.
And I think that's true, because I think, like, a lot of the time people will be like, oh, well, like, I wouldn't have done that back then. And it's kind
of
like, you probably would have.
Of course,
because that was normal.
And Jordan Peele, as a satirist, as well as a lover of horror movies, was not going to let that happen on his watch.
Good
not
writing.
In his movies.
It was really good writing.
Yeah, it's a satisfying movie. I shouldn't quibble about the action, because the action was good and realistic and believable, and he didn't fall into those terrible horror movie cliches, except for that one where the brother comes back from the dead, like Freddy the 13th. But Friday the 13th. That's pretty good. Let's do a new series of movies of Freddy the 13th, the 13th Freddy. But in any case, but he did that knowingly. Mm-hmm. He did that knowingly. To sort of like give a nod to that trope. So that's worth seeing, and not a lot of action, but the action that was in it was good.
Mm-hmm.
Now we get on to, before our big wind-up, which is going to get really ugly, we get to Kong, which is what Miko and I saw tonight, and what Jen should have seen, but she's very busy on a very important project, and I'm happy for it. I hope it works out for the best, but you still should have seen it with us, because I wanted your feedback today, because they had a very strong female character, played by Brie Larson, who, you know...
Actually, that's true. I trust her judgment.
Yeah, and it's an interesting movie. Kong, it's directed by Jordan Voight Roberts, who some of you may know as the brains, the executive producer, and mostly the writer of the wonderful FX comedy, You're the Worst.
Mm-hmm.
And he is the director of Kong, Skull Island. And
is this his first film?
I don't know if it's his first. I think it is.
I was action like, is this film. Like one of those guys who like has a TV show and then he gets handed this massive movie?
Yeah,
is that what just happened?
That's what happened. But the cool thing about it is that his You're the Worst is nothing like Kong.
Mm-hmm.
So he brings his sensibility. I would highly recommend that you see a binge watch You're the Worst, because it's an awesome show.
Mm-hmm.
It's very acerbic and satiric. It's about two lovely young people, one English, one American, who are trying to fall in love. She's depressed. She's clinically depressed. But they handle it in such a funny, fresh, involving, interesting way. And so what is this guy, I'm wondering to myself, doing Kong? Mm-hmm. And then it takes place in 1973. They create a mythos for Skull Island,
yes,
which is where Kong was in the original. They have a couple of the callbacks. Oh, we didn't even mention the callbacks in Logan. They had a lot of callbacks in Logan.
Yes, yes.
They had one of the ex-kids is holding a Wolverine toy, yeah, dressed in the original,
yellow and
light blue spandex costume with the kind of horny things that he has, the horns on his head.
Yeah.
They also have comics, the X-Men comics.
Actual X-Men comics.
As a subplot.
Right.
So there are a lot of callbacks.
Even the little boy, Richter, that's a mutant in the series,
too. So they were doing a lot of sweet callbacks. The more you know about Logan, the more you might enjoy Logan. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But be that as it may, and the more you know about Kong, the more you might enjoy Kong Skull Island. It takes place in 1973.
Yes.
And unfortunately, it takes place in 73 at the fall of Saigon, immediately after the fall of Saigon.
Right.
And that unfortunately intrudes on the film. Miko and I think, and you can disagree with my estimation of your feelings on the film, both agree that it was a little too overloaded. The plot was too clunky, had too many things in it, and probably
too many subplots, or
not subplots, but too many bells they were trying to ring.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a little bit.
And the big bell that they should never have tried to ring was the Vietnam War, because Samuel L. Jackson turns into Queeg. Not Queeg. Is it Queeg, the guy who went after the Moby Dick? I think it was Queeg.
Ahab?
Yes, Ahab.
Okay.
Who's Queeg? Oh, Queeg is the Kane Mutiny. But he turns into Queeg and Ahab in that he decides he's going to kill Kong because Kong represents to him their failure in the war.
Yeah.
And so he's going to,
that's a great reason to drag all these people on this trip.
Well, and that's the problem.
That wasn't the reason they went onto this trip, but there's the reason why they stay longer than they should.
Yeah, and it's also a reason why the movie is longer than it should be and has too much plot, because he's going on his great white whale digression, which is unfortunate.
Mm-hmm.
Because the rest of the movie is pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed it, I think, more than you did, right, Megan?
I do. Well, the movie started similarly to Godzilla, where they have like historical footage, sort of mixing real life event with the myths, sort of like the lore that they're building.
Yeah.
So the film is beautiful, absolutely cinematography wise, it's absolutely beautiful because the guy that did the cinematographer. And his name is Larry Fong, and he did 300.
Yeah.
He did Watchmen. He did Sucker Punch. He did Super 8.
I'd like to point out. I love Super 8, because I was like, you just named a bunch of movies that were like all flair and like all form and no substance.
But that's what Kong is as well.
Yeah.
Because
I know that's why you wanted to see it.
That's exactly why I didn't want to see it.
I was like, I'll rent it from the library. Like, I'm not paying money.
So from the start, when I saw the trailer, the shot with Kong is absolutely beautiful, and that's why
the posters were beautiful.
Wanted to see it.
God's sake.
So
we already told you we would pay for you.
With this film, there is a lot of issues, however, with this film in terms of how it was shot. There are times I feel like the editing wasn't good at all, because one of the moments that I remember the most is when they try to show the clips of the island to the army.
Yeah.
That short, like, 2-minute sequence has, like, at least 17 cuts. It shouldn't be more than 12 cuts.
Yeah.
It's just way too many. They will cut too fast, too. So if I'm talking and the camera's on me, it'd be right before, like, as soon as I finish my sentence, not even, like, half a beat, it will cut to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just kills the emotional buildup. There was a lot of cliche in the film as well.
Unfortunately, yes. There was cliches, but it had a very good and handsome cast.
Mm-hmm. It does.
Tom Hiddleston, as I mentioned, I don't like to talk during the movie, but unless I'm sighing or smacking my forehead or something. But right after they introduced Tom Hiddleston, I leaned over to Miko and said, oh, he's auditioning for James Bond. He's always auditioning for James Bond.
See, I agree with that. The reason why, one of the biggest reasons why is he had the beard when he was getting interviewed for the job.
Right.
He cut it clean off right after, and he stayed perfectly clean for 3 fucking days in the island.
I hate movies. That's like The Walking Dead. I'm just like, how come none of the girls have hairy armpits, man?
Yeah, really, man. So,
like, no one's got time to fucking shave. Yeah.
So that's one of the things I agree that he's definitely trying to be something.
I want him to be James Bond.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm team Idris Elba.
I'm fine with him too. But believe me, if they have to go with somebody other than Daniel Craig, I'd like it to be Hiddleston. Brie Larson is lovely to look at. Mm-hmm. It's understandable that Kong likes her.
Mm-hmm. I would say the interaction. Again, this movie has so much plot, but at the same time, it cuts so much information out of it. It just absolutely, like, destroys the character development.
Is Brie Larson the only girl in the movie?
Yes, she is. So
is she, like...
No, she's not. There's the Chinese actress.
Chinese actor. I was going to say, because it's co-funding, it's one of those films where they have to have an Asian actor, and it's usually a girl who speaks 4 to 5 lines of simple dialogue and just be there, be pretty, and get the money.
And try to pronounce her R's and her L's.
Oh, right. And that's pretty much it.
Yeah. And
she didn't do anything.
Was Brie Larson's character, was she like... what is it? Who studies primates? Like,
She was actually a photojournalist.
Yeah. Okay.
Who went to this island at the same time she was, one of her photos might have been on the cover of Time magazine. Mm-hmm. But 1973, she was fine. The actors did an enormous job with very little. Mm-hmm. They were given very little. The only guy who got a lot, and you wanted to see more of him because he was kind of like the TSA guy in Get Out, John C. Reilly.
Yeah. He's actually a very good character.
He was
sensible.
Awesome.
He's the character himself.
Yeah. The only thing that was out of character a little bit was that after he said that pit was dangerous, he still went in. I didn't like that.
I didn't mind that because he already established that he was suicidal at that point.
Right, that's true.
I'm going to die with you guys. But he was the heart of the movie. The movie started with him. Mm-hmm. It ended with him. Mm-hmm. And he was the emotional heart of it.
Yeah, throughout the whole thing.
Yeah, you don't care about Hiddleston or Brie Larson.
Uh-huh.
I'm happy they survived.
I was literally about to be like, I could never watch a movie where I have to care about John C. Reilly. And then I was like, Wreck-It Ralph, never mind.
Yeah, oh, there you go. Absolutely.
Damn it.
Oh, he was awesome in this. I mean, he brought so much to his part.
He did.
And I have to assume that he made up some of his lines. He improvised because he was so naturally such a good actor. The whole stuff with him and his relationship with the humans on the island, on Skull Island.
Yeah.
With his expressions, he spoke volumes when he looked into their eyes because they didn't speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
the natives didn't speak.
Which is a good sort of little thing to do to not sort of make up a language for the natives or have the natives speak English. So they just kind of like be silent.
And also I kind of loved it because you make noise on that island, you're asking for trouble.
Yes. Yeah.
Because there are things there that will come for you.
Yeah.
Fighting. You guys want to talk about fighting?
Yes, I'm getting to that because the...
One second.
Yes, go ahead.
Before. Again, with the... when the character building was so bad, at one point where Tom Hiddleston's character and Brie Larson's character was standing on the edge of a mountain looking down the river that they need to go past to get to the boat to get out, Kong steps in, and Kong just stood there and somehow was just kind of dumbfounded by her beauty and didn't kill them all. Didn't kill both of them. Which I feel like...
No, they had already established that he was protecting his land because they were using all those explosives.
Right.
And he wasn't going to kill...
He wasn't
going
to kill anyone, but he was... Kong wasn't... It's not out of character, but it just feels like the motivation of him coming closer to her was kind
of
bad.
Because, of course, but I let
but
them
they have
that.
A shot. They have a shot of them holding hands.
Yeah.
I wish it would have one little shot, just another shot, a couple more shots of Kong looking at them holding hands and sort of have that look of flashing back because he was alone now. He's an orphan now.
Right.
Flashing back to when he had someone.
Yeah.
When he had someone. That's why he didn't do anything to them or come close to them because of that. I wish there's just that little more
That's film language. absolutely.
Just a little bit more.
But of course, what they depended on was my kind of past, because I have seen all the Kong movies. Mm-hmm. I saw King Kong.
I expected that.
Unfortunately, yes.
I expected that Kong would sort of fall in love.
The T-Rex was good enough.
Oh, that was fantastic. That
good part.
That fight was.
We were talking about that because, well, let me quickly say that the fight, they have a fight choreographer on Kong named Ilram Choi, who was a stuntman and is now the fight choreographer for Spider-Man Homecoming.
Okay. Oh.
The new Spider-Man movie, that's what I said.
That might be good.
That might be good. The stunt coordinator was Spiro Razatos, who did Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Out of the Shadows, Monster Trucks, Furious 7, but also Captain America Civil War and Captain America Winter Soldier.
What?
So you have one bad one in there.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say which one.
Well, the movies weren't, but the choreography was fine. The fights here were fine. And the fights were almost, although I'm sure they involved the humans as well, because there was a lot of action with the humans.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked, there was a huge battle with Kong at the end with the big monster. There are a bunch of smaller monsters. There's also giant spiders and all sorts of other things. They may have had scenes with giant ants, which are alluded to, but you never see them in the film.
Yeah, yeah. They cut too much.
But the final fight, I thought, was nice and smooth.
Yes.
And had power and was believable. And it was interesting. I was amused that Kong's final move, which was actually pretty sweet, mm-hmm. was very similar, and also I was extremely happy that Kong was the star of the movie.
Yeah.
He wasn't a walk-on the way, or a cameo the way Godzilla was.
He's definitely more intelligent in this one than any other King Kong that I have seen.
Yeah.
He's
more expressive, sir.
Expressive, yes.
Because the technology has gotten better.
Right, not just that, effects. Like, his behavior, it's also, I feel smarter than the other one.
The big close-ups of his face might have been motion capture. I don't know who was playing him.
Yeah.
But it was evocative, and it worked. And his final move was very similar to the one really good moment in the Godzilla movie, where Godzilla opens up the monster's mouth and then shoots his laser ray, or whatever it's called, his power ray, down the thing's gullet. There was some also very sweet things here when he eats, when John Goodman gets eaten by the younger monster.
Oh, yeah.
And his flash thing goes off. That was super clever. Yeah, throughout the thing's body.
How they tracked him.
Yeah, there's some very sweet things in this movie.
Yeah, it just wasn't really well, even the sweet things wasn't really well connected, other than Kong's fight. Yeah. I always have to say the last, when Kong fought the Skull Crawlers.
Right.
The biggest one.
Yeah, the mama Skull Crawler.
The mama, yeah.
Yeah.
They did tease a little bit, because at one point he went for his face, when he went for his neck, he grabbed his jaw and he was opening up.
Yeah.
So there's like a tease of like, oh, it's going to have the same fight as the last King Kong. It didn't.
No.
It went through the whole thing.
Yeah.
But I do feel like the end, I think you feel the same. It was a little bit anticlimactic at the end.
Yes, it wasn't.
They don't have to end at that point.
I didn't even know the monster was dead.
It
happened so suddenly. It was a really sweet thing.
Yeah.
Brie Larson is thrown off a cliff, falls into the water. Mm-hmm. Kong, it looks like she's going to drown. Kong sort of interrupts the fight to grab her, but then the monster attacks him again. And so the monster...
Did he die?
The monster?
No, King Kong.
No.
Of course not. And I'll tell you why.
Yeah.
Because at that, he's holding onto the girl, and all the monster's trying to do is eat the girl.
Mm-hmm.
And he wraps his little mouth, tongue, tentacle around Kong's wrist and pulls his fist into his own gullet all the way down. So he's just trying to eat the girl and the arm. And Kong rips his arm out so hard that he tears
pretty much
all
the whole internal
everything out.
Yeah, everything out.
But you can't even really tell.
Gross.
Yeah. So right before that, the reason why Kong has time to save Brie Larson's character is because he was using the propellers from the boat.
Oh yeah,
to
that was
slice
awesome
her
too.
Neck.
Yeah.
So I thought
like the monster's neck.
Yeah, right.
Flight.
So that's a good moment.
Mm-hmm.
But I know the monster's not dead.
It was.
I wished again like same thing. One more shot of Kong struggling to pull that thing would have made it way more
great example, Miko. That's exactly right. You know, in other words, they always have the opportunity to set it up and then pay it off, and they rarely do.
Yeah.
They set it up, but then they don't pay it off. That was a great scene where Kong is knocked back into the remains of a ship, mm-hmm. and all the chains on the ship and the propeller and the anchor are wrapped around him, and he's sort of like trapped, and he can't get out, and then he eventually rips it off, and then he gets the propeller attached to the chain
right.
as a weapon, which is awesome, but it's not... And then I was in the audience going, oh, that's awesome, but then it's not used
yeah.
in a way that I go, yeah!
It's not like that scene in Pacific Rim where they grab the big oil tanker ship.
Oh, yeah, that paid off.
The only wow. one thing in that whole movie that paid off.
I will fight you right now.
Let's fight right now. And let's fight like they do in Pacific Rim in that you're your nationality and I'm my nationality, but we won't fight using our nationality.
Oh, my gosh.
We won't fight. I won't fight using Kung Fu and you won't... You know, that's what drove me crazy about Pacific Rim. I think we talked about this before.
Oh, yeah.
All of these teams are nationalities yeah, and they don't use any of their fighting styles.
I didn't
styles.
Even think about that at all, but that makes so much
They're
sense.
All generic. All of them fight yeah. exactly the same way, and the same thing with the kaiju.
Well, other than the Hong Kong brothers, they yeah. fight a little different. That's because they have three arms.
But they don't use
yeah,
Kung
they
Fu.
Don't, yeah, they don't use
Speaking
anything,
of
yeah.
Kung Fu, but let's get to the end of Kong, because what they do at the end of Kong, there is a scene afterwards.
Yes.
There's a scene after the credits mm-hmm. where they establish very clearly that this is not just a single movie anymore. This yeah. is part
they
of a franchise.
The whole thing.
They show Godzilla.
Oh, wait, they show Godzilla?
They didn't show Godzilla.
They do, but they don't.
Well, they don't. They show
they
the painting.
They show
paintings.
An image
yeah.
of him.
So what they did at the end was sort of, oh, like, hey, we're Monarch.
There's this organization called Monarch, which John Goodman started back in the 70s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's why he wound up going to the island. But after he's killed, spoiler alert, his assistant and the Chinese assistant
yep.
Come in and reveal to Brie Larson and to Tom Hiddleston that
there's
that
more
they're now part of Monarch. Which
why is the Chinese girl telling them about Godzilla?
The Chinese girl's a biologist.
I'm just being a dick. I'm sorry.
She's biologist.
And she needs to be there for the Chinese money.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
It's co-produced by a Chinese company.
Oh, my God. It's like Avengers with giant monster animals.
Yeah. Yep. So at the end. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it is. That's why I like and don't
Everyone's
like about
gotta
it.
Everyone's got to get on that cinematic universe.
I know. That's why I like and don't like about it.
I know. I get it.
And the other thing, too. Like
they
show everything. Yeah. They show the paintings of freaking Godzilla. They show
King Ghidorah.
King Ghidorah. They show the moth.
Mothra.
And they show
Rodan. The winged creature.
The pterodactyl.
Let them fight.
And yeah. Hydra.
And Hydra, yeah.
Yeah.
And so...
So they show everything.
The last thing you
know
hear
what
in the entire movie is Godzilla's roar.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's Godzilla's beautiful design roar that, like, just... gets into your heart and like yeah. makes you giggle.
I almost tried to do it just now, but I was like, y'all don't need that.
I would have to say, like, in terms of like the whole Godzilla movie, that's my favorite thing about it. It's just like his voice.
Oh,
his roar is so damn good.
Yeah. Iconic.
It was
iconic.
Yeah,
that's it.
Yes, and that was thrilling to me
personally.
Design. Then I remembered that it's Warner Brothers, and I'm going, oh, I pray they don't fuck it up.
Yeah,
like they fuck up Batman, Superman, and everything else.
As long as they do it beautiful.
And as long as they bring talent like the guy who does You're the Worst onto stuff like this, at least they show that they have some imagination. But the problem with Warners is that they interfere, that their executives interfere. And they shouldn't. They just should let people. If they really want to copy Disney / Marvel / Lucasfilm / Pixar, they would learn that lesson too. Mm-hmm. Get good talent and don't effing interfere.
Well, I was gonna say they have DC, so they couldn't really start the franchise with DC that yeah. well. They're trying now with Kong and Godzilla, which is another big gigantic universe and franchise.
Right.
So.
And the television DC stuff is cool.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
now we're gonna talk. Speaking of TV, we're jumped into TV for our last two things, and I don't think either of you guys have seen either of these.
We've seen the first episode of Into Badlands.
I saw a number of episodes, and he gave me snark for like wanting to watch it.
But you didn't see the second season.
No.
Because seeing the first season is useless.
Oh,
because what the first thing that happens, we're going to talk about Into the Badlands.
Like retcon everything?
What's that mean?
Oh, like retrocon, like, oh God. That's kind of like when a comic book series or a show, like, they'll establish something as canon.
Yeah.
And then later on in the show, they'll like contradict it or they'll like be like, oh, well, like, we're doing something else now.
That's, yeah.
Oh.
This is what
happens. Like, basically, like, DC, yeah. like, the New 52.
Yeah.
That's, like, right. they retcon, like, the entire fucking, like, industry.
Here's the deal with Into the Badlands. I saw Iron Fist. I binged watched Iron
you
Fist.
You did?
I
bought you.
Because, he had to.
Because everybody was asking me about it. I'm at the I'm at Icon 32, which is the Long Island comic convention, and everybody is coming up to me and saying, "Have you seen it yet? Have you seen it yet? Have you seen it yet?" And then I'm getting texts and Twitters and all the other Instagrams and everything saying, well, "What did you think? What did you think? Let me tell you what you think. I wanted to know what you thought." So I would go home and watch it in bed on my iPad, and oh my, I wish you guys had been around so you could hear the smacking of the forehead and the sighing and the chin on my thing. Scott Buck, who did Dexter and 6 Feet Under, was the creator of the Iron Fist television show. Poor Finn Jones, who plays the lead, and poor Jessica Henwick as Colleen Wing, is stuck in we were all hoping that the advance word that this was so bad was not true, but it's not worse, mm-hmm. because have you seen the other ones, Jessica Jones and
Nico has,
and,
I haven't.
And
yes,
Luke
I have.
Cage,
yep.
and Daredevil. Yep. As they have been going on, for me, it is becoming more and more obvious that these are 6-episode stories in 13-episode packages.
Huh.
And like Jessica Jones and Luke Cage, to me, got hilarious at times, the way they were killing time, the way they were treading water, the way they were wasting motion. It was just repetition. All the dialogue is self-conscious and contrived.
I have to say, the same thing happened with Daredevil 2, Season 2.
Yes.
Season 1 was great.
Yes.
Season 2 started, it kind of felt the same
it was,
way.
They're always overstuffed. Well, Iron Fist, you've got a problem. The original character is not good. The original character was based on a bunch of writers watching Bruce Lee movies.
I was like, agreed!
With no real conception of what they're doing at all. I often said that at the beginning of my researching martial art movies, I was like a Chinese man who had seen a baseball movie and thought it was great but knew nothing about baseball. Just thought it was great. I mean, they're running around and they're catching balls and they're swinging bats and it's really exciting and everybody is cheering. And so, you know, I'm going to become an expert on baseball movies but not knowing anything about baseball. So here they're trying to create this character to take advantage of the Bruce Lee mania, and so they create a white boy who learns in quotes kung fu, and so he comes. So the show starts, and in order, and again, it I was expecting this. It wasn't like I wasn't expecting it.
Uh-huh.
A six episode story in a 13-episode package. And but in order to fill those 13 episodes, they make him so stupid. And it's not enough that the leading character, Danny Rand, mm-hmm. Iron Fist, is stupid. Everyone's stupid.
Oh, geez.
It starts at the very beginning with everyone reacting in a contrived, unrealistic, exaggerated way,
mm-hmm.
and then it got increasingly ludicrous because whenever two characters would stop and talk,
mm-hmm.
they would stop
and talk,
like this.
Oh my God.
Virtually every other line of dialogue might as well have had a big dot, dot, dot. So do you think? Yes, I think so. And I'm going, you guys are really being blatant about this.
Mm-hmm.
And then I said, all right, I know the kung fu is going to suck. I know it is.
Mm-hmm.
So let me see how sucky it is. It wasn't terrible. Fight choreographer Brett Chan, who worked on Marco Polo in the Hercules movie, assistant fight coordinator Hiro Minami, who was a previous stunt performer promoted here, assistant fight coordinator Shane Yan, also a stunt performer promoted, assistant fight coordinator Melee Kim, whose last fight choreographer job was on a movie called Female Fight Club.
Well,
so who knows? So here's the deal. He starts doing the standard kind of mixed martial arts,
mm-hmm.
but then there's this character, Colleen Wing.
So wait, he like landed in Mystic China to learn MMA?
No, he didn't land there. There was a plane crash.
No, I know, but I'm just saying, like, he
didn't learn MMA. He learned the mystical force. The channel.
Channels
the universe,
exactly,
correct?
Like
well, yes, but what he explains to the character of Colleen Wing, mm-hmm. who is another. Everybody is emotionally retentive in this. Mm-hmm. Everyone is just so frustrating. They're all depressed. They're all stupid. They're all, you know, they'll cut off their nose to spite their faces. And so he's explaining Kung Fu to Colleen, who teaches some sort of kenpo.
She's the master of her dojo, isn't she?
Yeah, well, her dojo is in a cellar that's running out of money, and nobody will stay her student. I understand why. She's a terrible teacher, teaching stupid stuff. You know, here she again, this slight little anorexic-type girl who is fighting guys in cage matches, huge muscular cage matches, the exact same way they're fighting her, with closed fists and hi-ya, and hi-ya, and kick, rip off of Tony Jaa stuff. So he's explaining to her. So Danny is explaining to her, because he's an idiot too.
Mansplaining.
Yeah, he's mansplaining, yes. That's right.
Oh, yeah.
And he says, well, you know, it's your inner force. And I immediately, my chin goes
that
down.
That sounds like a like palm slap.
My palm slap, because...
Iconic.
We know what inner force is? Inner force is like saying warring peace.
Mm-hmm.
It's like peaceful war. No, it's not force. The whole idea of Kung Fu is it's not force.
Mm-hmm.
It's inner energy.
Mm-hmm.
It's not inner force. So he says force, and then he explains this all to her. You use your inner force. But the big fight scene in the whole show, it's 13 episodes, and they have one decent fight scene.
Wow.
And it's not even particularly good, and it's another fight scene ripped off from Old Boy.
What episode? Oh. What?
The fourth episode. Well, that's another example. Usually the good fight scene is in the third episode.
Yeah.
Here
yeah.
it's in the fourth episode, because, again, they're killing time. And it's one of these hallway elevator fight scenes. And he's doing... I mean, Bruce Willis in Die Hard, which one? And Captain America, they have elevator fight scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all better than this one. They're much better than this one. And also, the other thing that's it's wonderful, both Bruce Willis and Captain America, in their elevator fight scene, when the fight scene is over, this is what they sound like. When Danny Rand's fight scene is over, this is what he sounds like. No, not the car. It's not the car alarm going off again.
It's the same car going off.
We have to take a pause.
Well, we'll see if we take a pause. But anyway, well, I'll get back to this. This is what Danny Rand sounds like.
I thought Daredevil should sound like that because he's an actual fighter.
It's like an anime character.
But he's supposed to sound better because he had this power.
He has this power. He should not be out of breath.
Right.
He should not be out of breath. And he using his fist, he's tired, his mouth is open. It's like, this is not Kung Fu. But then again, I said this a bunch of times to people when we were talking about this even before I saw it all. When you're starting with a flawed source. You're starting with a comic book based on limited knowledge,
mm-hmm.
very limited knowledge,
mm-hmm.
and now you have a television show, unfortunately, with very limited training time, as well as very limited skills of the actors. They hired people to play the parts rather than people who actually knew what they were talking about.
Yeah.
And of course, all the fight coordinators and choreographer are not versed in Kung Fu. They're not versed in Iron Fist. They don't.
When you read off the names of the people and their past stuff, I was just like, what were they thinking? Like, this is the show to go all out on.
Again,
like,
yeah, mixed.
Mm-hmm.
Especially since you have a flawed concept to begin with.
I would say, especially since you piss off half of your fan base already.
Yeah.
More than half.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
More than half. Because he's. And even without him being white,
mm-hmm.
he's not a very good actor.
Even without him being
white, he doesn't have charisma.
For me, the pretense of the show, like Miko and I were talking about this, we were talking about how the other three shows, they have a character that's got this big flaw.
Yeah.
You know, one's disabled, one's depressed, one is dealing with like the discrimination of just being who they are.
Right.
And then with this guy, it's just like, it's kind of like Iron Man, where it's like, you like Iron Man, but it's not because like, you would necessarily like identify with
it's
him.
His
like
charisma.
You don't feel bad for
it's
him.
It's his charisma.
But this guy, it's like you have nothing to. He's rich.
He lost his parents, but he's like, I'm gonna get my company.
But that's not even the issue.
Yeah.
The issue is that he's not a good actor. He's tofu.
Oh,
he's tofu.
You know, and they don't add sauce to him.
Yeah.
They don't add sauce to him. I mean, that's the issue. I mean, if you gave that part,
the soup bland.
If you gave that part, no, it's not even. It's the soup is not. It's not the soup's fault. It's the chef. It's, you know, in other words, if you gave this to Robert Downey Jr., you gave this to the guys...
Donnie Yen.
You gave this to any... No, not Louis that. Donnie Yen's kind of pretty much a blank slate.
It should have been Louis Tang.
He's not... No, he's just blank. If you saw the last couple of Ip Man movies, he's trying not to act. He doesn't want to act anymore, so he's just like dead on arrival. So the actor with charisma can sell it. But this guy is not likable because, not because he's not supposed to be likable, he's just an idiot. The character's an idiot.
What else has he done?
I don't know. I haven't looked that up.
Yeah.
I just,
you can look it up.
All I ever say is that it's poor Finn Jones because he's not up to the task. He's kind of like, you know, they got a great actor to star in that Dragon movie years ago. And he had that same curly blonde hair, and he went on to be a great actor. I'll have to put it in the supplementals because I'm blanking on his name now. But he didn't work at all in the movie. He was just too bland. And Iron Fist is really a very, very boring watch. The fights are not well done or imaginative or correct, and it adds nothing to the. To the character. But again, I understand the problem. You have a flawed origin. You shouldn't have done it in the first place. And once you've done it, is it your right to improve upon the source material? I think so.
Yes.
But apparently they didn't. Apparently they said, okay, we have an energetically closed, intrinsically flawed concept. We're going to go with it.
Well, usually with adaptations, it's try to make it better.
Yeah. Well, you would hope.
Or showing some type of difference between the original material and the visual improvement and the character, more character development, or limited of.
Now, I'm going to quote Keanu Reeves, of all people, who, when he got the original script for Speed, he supposedly handed it back to the producer and said, I think we can do better than this. And I love when somebody says that, whether it's Doctor Strange or Keanu Reeves. And they should have done that here. So, I finished that, and I'm going... Well, I love Stephen Fung. I love Daniel Wu. These guys I've known for 15 years. And so I was saying, and I heard all sorts of things that they did for the new season of Into the Badlands. And I thought we were going to be, I said, save me. Save me, gentlemen. So I turn on Into the Badlands. And the very first thing that comes up on screen is 6 months later. And it might as well have said 6 years later.
Oh,
it might have said 60 years later. It might as well have said 600 years later.
Oh,
because they went from filming it in Nolens to filming it in Ireland.
What?
What other show films in Ireland? Game of Thrones.
Oh, I was like Outlanders? I don't fucking know.
Outlanders too, I think. I'm not sure about that. I'll have to look it up. But I said, oh my God. They're ripping off Game of Thrones. Because, you know, Into the Badlands is executive produced and written by Alfred Goh and Miles Millar. And if you remember last year, my biggest complaint is not a single line of dialogue was interesting, inventive, imaginative, amusing, anything. It was all cliches. One cliche after, one stereotypical conversation dialogue line after another. Watch out. Be careful. Don't look back. Whatever. It's just all, it was all crap. Now, they have done in the past, I Am Number Four, Herbie Fully Loaded,
Jesus.
Shanghai Noon.
This is not going well.
That's right. And so, these guys trade in stereotypes. The rumor is, and I apologize if this is incorrect, but the story I hear is they're able to please networks and producers. In other words, they give these mediocre producers and networks what they want, and that's how they get by. They give them sellable, marketable stuff. And they do that by trading in cliches and stereotypes that the executives recognize.
Right.
And you know, and they will change it any way they say. So here they have changed the show into Mad Max. And it starts, but with three other things, too. They're taking pieces of everything and smacking them all together.
Is that established in the first season, or is it...
No!
Slowly? I was like, not the, like, five episodes I saw.
Like I said, 6 months later, and suddenly we can reboot the whole effing thing.
So what is it like in the first season, if you have to compare it to a
well,
show?
Well, in the first season, it's some sort of strange Twilight Zone. They're trying to get away with the idea that in the future, there are no guns, and therefore you have to be able to fight with knives. And I'm saying, what are knives? knives made of? Knives are made of the same things that guns are made of. So what, they don't have the black powder, which they have to go with Matt Damon to the Great Wall to get? I mean, what is going... It doesn't make any sense. Nothing makes sense. It makes... Not only does it make less sense now, because now they're taking a little bit of season one, and they're taking a little bit of Game of Thrones, they're taking a lot of Mad Max, they're taking a little bit of what else? There's some Shaolin Temple type stuff going on, but it's all beautiful, beautifully photographed in Ireland. Mm-hmm. But there's the immediate problem. They start with showing that our hero, played by Daniel Wu, is now been captured and made a slave at a mine where you have to dig. Dig for what? I'm not sure. I think they're digging for unobtainium. Because they don't really explain
the black powder.
Yeah.
That's
so
what they're digging.
They're in these big...
I would like for a real plot.
He's in a chain gang with a big wooden yoke attached by chains. And there's this character right out of Star Wars, The Force Awakens, who's telling him the lay of the land. You're here now and you'll be here for the rest of your life. And if you do anything wrong, we'll kill you. Mm-hmm. And so one of the guards says, there's a guy who's spitting up blood, another one of the slaves. And so he's damaged. And so the weaselly little guy's leader says, the boss man says, kill him. And so for genius reasons, Daniel Wu, still chained up, decides to save this guy. And he saves this guy with some lovely choreography. Mm. Some really lovely Jackie Chan-like choreography using the space, using the props, using the area, using his skill, because Stephen Fung was the protege of Jackie Chan for a while. Jackie Chan produced, to my mind, Stephen Fung's best movie, which was A House of Fury, which Daniel Wu was in. And so I know Stephen Fung can do great work. And Stephen Fung, I'm happy to see, is directing two episodes this season.
Oh, cool.
I may come back and watch those two episodes just because I like Steven a lot. Mm-hmm. And I also appreciate it. However, so this is a lovely little scene, even though it's just a cliche why he's trying to save this guy.
Yeah, it like harkens back to a bigger problem.
It's a knee-jerk reaction to save this guy. This guy's sick anyway. He's dying anyway. Mm. But then during the fight, Daniel Wu's character kills two guards, at least two, if not more. Maybe they're wounded, but you're never alluded to. I mean, at one point, one of the guards' knives goes into the back of his head. I think he's dead. And at around that same time, it is mentioned that because you're chained together to another slave, if you even piss by accident on that other slave, you'll be executed. You'll be summarily executed for accidentally pissing yourself. He kills two guards. Nothing happens to him. The next scene, he's just being chained up to another actor. Now, this actor is lovely. This actor is Nick Frost, who's a wonderful, funny actor who has teamed up with, I forgot the guy from, he was in all these terrific British comedies. Edgar Wright.
Yeah.
He's part of that gang.
Yeah.
And Nick Frost is great because... obviously, Nick Frost is writing his own dialogue, you know, because he's not doing all the cliches.
Oh my gosh, I didn't know Nick Frost was in this.
And he's a mile-a-minute talker. He's all dirty with a huge beard. But there's a small problem. Not actually a small one, a fairly large one, which is everyone else at this mine, they're all slaves. And the Nick Frost slave has apparently been there for a long time because he's talking about the last guy he was chained to who shit himself to death. And you know, that kind of thing. And that's the kind of stuff he's coming up with, and it's very funny. But Nick Frost, the last thing Nick Frost played was Santa Claus on a Doctor Who Christmas special. Nick Frost is not a slave.
Yeah.
He's not emaciated. Everyone else in this place is emaciated. I'm saying to myself, what is this guy eating? What are they feeding this guy? Because he's huge.
Yeah.
And it's like the whole show is riddled with inconsistencies and illogicals like that that just stop me dead.
Yeah.
You know, you can't piss on your own leg or they'll kill you. You kill two guards and everything's fine. No one ever mentions it. And it's, the whole show is just riddled with this stuff, but the fighting. Stephen Fung is still the choreographer. They also, I'm going to let you read this guy's name because I want to pronounce it properly. The name under Stephen Fung.
Stephen Fung,
Ku
Huan Chu.
Ku Who Hwenshu?
I'm like, you don't even know.
Who Hwenshu? And you're Chinese.
Yeah, Miko.
Who are you?
Write it in Chinese and I'll read it out loud.
Yeah. All right. Oh, that's a good point. But anyway, he worked on Journey to the West, Conquering the Demons and the Mermaid.
Wait, is that the one that we watched?
Yes.
Yeah.
Both Stephen Chow movies.
Oh, yeah, the Mermaid.
He also worked on the Four trilogy and House of Fury, Stephen Fung's best movie, which was choreographed by Yuen Woo-ping. Mm-hmm. So they're both involved in the choreography. Unfortunately, they're choreographing a bunch of, in addition to Daniel Wu, they're choreographing a bunch of white people, and a lot of women, all who fight in high heels, not all, just one major character fights in real, they have fetishistic shots of her high heels. Jeez. Her high heels are part of her character.
Yeah.
I forgot the name of the character. I couldn't care by the end of it.
Did she use a high heel to fight, though?
No.
No?
No, of course. She's just running upstairs and using her blades. But it's like, by this time in the show, my eyes were rolling so much, I sounded like Godzilla's roar.
Yeah.
It was just like, I could not believe. You know, I have this line that I use for things like Pacific Rim and other things like that. When anything is possible, nothing is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, it's not so much that anything is possible, but anything goes.
Mm-hmm.
They do whatever they want. It's all contrived. They don't
care.
There
are no rules.
Yeah, they don't care if any of it makes sense.
Hey, man, this is the Badlands.
No, yeah, well, that's pretty much. They don't even say that. I wish they had said that. But so there's the phone. Anybody good?
Yeah.
Do you have to get it?
No, I don't have to get
okay,
it.
Okay, all right. That's all right.
Always
we have car alarms going off. So unfortunately, Into the Badlands was well named.
I was like, you went, yeah.
I'm not planning to watch it again. I was so disappointed. I thought it was going to save me from Iron Fist.
Yeah, I was excited to hear you like contrast those two because I had very low expectations for one and then very high expectations for the other one.
They're both
and they both fail you. Oh, yeah.
They're disappointing. At least the Daniel Wu Kung Fu that Stephen Fung does is fine, but unfortunately
it's not enough to keep you.
Yeah,
around.
Not enough because a good Kung Fu fight, just like all good fights in movies, should add to the plot, add to the characters, and when you have characters and plots that have no rules, then it's kind of pointless. It's pretty. Like, I think I told you that story that Stephen Fung, when I took him aside, said, why aren't the fights in season one have a meaning? Why don't they have a larger context? Why don't they mean anything in terms of the ongoing story? And he said, the only thing they told me is make it look cool.
Yeah.
No.
So it still looks cool, but it's now like four times as problematic, but it's pretty.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there's another thing that drives me crazy. There's a kid who the hero
Aramis Knight.
Yeah,
he played Bean on Ender's Game.
Right, right.
Which is the greatest? No, actually, it's whatever.
Whatever, but be that as it may, he's now at a temple. He's now at the Shaolin Temple by a waterfall, and he's doing all this stick training with this girl at the beginning of the episode, and you know she's.
And he likes her.
Well, there's all sorts of things going on. But anyway, they're clicking, and at one point he uses the stick to get under her defenses, and she's like, you're not supposed to hit me. I could call, you could be summarily executed or whatever if I told people that you actually hit me. And the next second, she takes her stick and pushes it into his, you know, she just hits him in the chest with it. And I'm like going, you just showed us that you guys were training together, and you stand there and just take a stick directly to the center of your chest, and he falls down, he's rubbing his chest like it surprised him. It's like he didn't do it because he wanted to let her get back at him.
Mm-hmm.
He actually is pretending that she surprised him. I'm saying, you're training in Kung Fu! The first thing you do is you do not stand there and it's happening throughout the show. People are smacking others in the face, slapping, and they're just standing there. Oh, it's really bad in Iron Fist. I mean, there are times in both the Danny Rand fights and in the Colleen Wing fights where you see the stunt people waiting. I mean,
oh, in the background?
No, no, not in the background. They're fighting two people at once, and Danny and or Colin are holding on to both their arms, mm-hmm. and so then she's hitting this guy over there, and then kicking this guy over there. But when she's hitting this guy, you see the guy on her. She's hitting
That's
somebody on her left.
That's like my favorite thing with fights. Yeah. It's like how like the henchmen are all like kind of waiting for their turn.
Waiting for their turn.
And it's like
she's hitting the guy on the left, and you see the one on the right waiting to be kicked.
Oh my god, that's like amazing.
Not doing anything. Just waiting to be kicked.
What did I watch? I think it was Jason Bourne the other day too.
Oh,
there are shots. It's similar to that. Yeah. It's not people waiting, but it's actors. It's I'm fighting you, but then after you punch me, I react. But then my reaction back is so slow that you have to wait till me punch you back.
Yeah, back again. Yeah, and again, this is supposed to be good. But anyway, so we've gone on for a while now. That was fun,
mm-hmm.
and we've as usual in our wonderful mobile sound studio, we have fogged up the windows. All the windows are fogged.
Yes.
So now let us look for us about a month. We're hopefully going to come back and talk about some American adaptations of Japanese projects, among other things. So yes, so we're all looking forward to that. And in 2 weeks we'll have hopefully another. I've been able to book and record some wonderful interviews with some amazing people. So I hope you'll come. I hope to hear that you're here to hear our next podcast, and we will end, as we always do, with a sign-off. I'll count off, and then we'll do it. All ready? 1, 2, 3. Use your blinkers, jackass.
Okay, break it up. Break it up. For now.
You don't give up, do you?
Listen in next time for more film fun, frenzy, and friends. Until then, check out actionfilmautopsy.com, where the excitement never ends.